Cory Booker was in Charleston, South Carolina today at the church where a white supremacist gunned down 9 black worshipers. It was just 4 years ago. Before the attack, the gunman was active on a storm front, one of the oldest and largest neo-Nazi and white supremacy hate sites on the internet. In investigating the Charleston gunman and his online presence, my next guest eventually met Derek Black. He's a former white nationalist who walked away from the hate-filled ideology. The Washington Post reporter and writer Eli Saslow spent years researching the white supremacy community. He's the author of Rising Out of Hatred, Derek Black's story, growing up as a white supremacist, and how he found his way out. Eli, welcome to the show. So let me start with how much, give a sense of how, what kind of problem this is on the internet, and how much this is a growing issue.
It's a massive problem. And unfortunately, it's not just a massive problem on the internet, as we're seeing increasingly. I mean, I think sometimes in this country, our primary problem has been we lie to ourselves about who we are and who we have been as a country. And it's comforting to think of these terrorists, these white supremacist terrorists, as outside agitators, as lone wolves, acting as extremists on their own. The truth is, many of these ideas in their manifestos, many of the ideas that we hear sometimes echoed in the Oval Office or the places of power in our country, are also widely held racist beliefs and assumptions throughout large parts of white America. And that's kind of the big thing that we need to confront, I think, to begin to move past it.
Well, look, Tucker Carlson sort of implied that this idea of white supremacy or all of this is somehow it's a hoax of some sort. David Duke took his words already and says, that's right, he's right. I mean, explain just the power of that exchange and what that does to normalize the idea of white supremacy and white nationalism.
I mean, I think that the idea that white supremacy is a hoax is factually ridiculous on its face. I mean, white supremacy still informs much of what our country is in this moment in terms of, you know, white people having power in the country, white people having more share of wealth, white people being privileged in almost every possible way. You know, white supremacy is the world we're all existing in. So I think that first needs to be acknowledged. And then you have a group of white nationalists, as they call themselves, who are constantly activating to try to further white supremacy and to further the country, the culture of white supremacy that has been such a part of this country. And that is a smaller group of people that are talking to each other on the internet, that are talking to each other through manifestos, that are talking to each other on podcasts. But they're acting out of an instinct that is a much more widely held thing in this country, powerful enough to get people elected.
With ISIS, there's an al-Baghdadi that was sort of the head recruiter, if you will. You had al-Awlaki, of AQAP, a recruiter for al-Qaeda out there. Is there a centralization to this, or is this a little more disparate?
I think one of the things that makes it so difficult to fight and confront is that it's really insidious and it's pretty diffuse because, you know, within white nationalism, you have a lot of different factions. You have people who would consider themselves almost more academic racists, people like Richard Spencer who say that they aren't, pushing violence, although that's not necessarily true, but who organize conferences and things like that. And then you have people who actively want to create violence and who look to people like Dylann Roof or other mass shooters as their icons in this movement. I think the most troubling thing, like the unifying thing for all of those people, if you spend time on Gab or 8chan or Stormfront, these places where white nationalists speak to each other, the people that they're going back to for inspiration, the quotes that they're resharing are quotes from people like Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, who is referenced earlier in this segment. I mean, these white nationalist ideas are a part of what we've been, and that's their powerful fuel. That is what is furthering their actions.
You have spent time with how people got out. Are these all young white men that get recruited here? I mean, it feels like there is a group that seems susceptible.
For sure. I mean, and it's not different than the group that's susceptible, frankly, for ISIS or for other, terrorist and extremist groups. These are mostly white, disaffected young men who are feeling badly about the way their lives are going for many reasons. And these white nationalist groups and this white nationalist ideology kind of comes in and almost absolves them of their own blame in right. how their lives are going and says, this isn't happening because of you. It's happening because of the invaders coming across right. the border or because people of color need to go back to some different place. Yeah. These factually inaccurate, hateful things. Yeah. But that's a powerful thing to offer somebody who feels disempowered.
Eli Zaslow, it's a tremendous book, and it's been a tremendous story for you to be covering. Unfortunately, you're going to be covering it a lot more. So.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Amir Deese. Welcome to this episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. There's something frightening that is happening in this country. And it really needs to be talked about because I think it's the biggest threat to anything getting done, which will help this country out immensely. I like to think of it as psychic numbing. Now, if you don't know what psychic numbing is, it's basically a process that a person goes through of numbing themselves against some harsh reality, some harsh new reality that they don't want to accept. Sometimes I think of it as delusion, which is somewhat worse because that includes you lying to yourself. I think the difference between psychic numbing and delusion is a person who is psychically numb to a situation can be put in front of whatever that situation is. So let's say, I don't know, it's a 200-foot monster, just as an example. You can put a psychically numb person in front of that 200-foot monster, and they may acknowledge it, but they'll go on pretending that it's not as big as a deal as it actually is. And then they'll retreat almost internally inside of themselves. And there's not really, if I understand it correctly, much of a shock or a shocked expressive look on their face as they're looking at this 200-foot monster. They'll lie about the significance of that monster, what it's doing, but they'll acknowledge it's kind of there. That's the psychically numbing effect that a person can impose on themselves to ignore something that they don't want to acknowledge. But then a person who is delusional, they're the ones that kind of scare me because they're the ones that you put in front of the 200-foot monster, and you can look at their face and tell that they know it's there, and that everything that is coming out of their mouth is a lie, and that they're scared, and they're fearful, and they're trying to make it go away like a child, trying to make something bad go away by hiding their face under the covers, or something scary go away by hiding their face under the cover. And you could tell this, and you could try to get them to realize in real time that what they're seeing is fact. And in order to maintain the delusion, they'll run, they'll hide, and if they have to, they will hurt you. So you can no longer impose your reality onto their delusionary state. That's the difference. The problem is, because I want it to be psychic numbing, doesn't mean that it is psychic numbing. It could easily be delusion. Most of you know what I'm going to talk about. You've experienced it. When you are not conservative and you're trying to have these conversations with conservatives, whether it's about global warming, mass shootings, white supremacy, even just the notion of coming together to fix social problems, there's a wall that separates you from them. Now, I'm not going to pretend, because, you know, I've looked at many a good progressive and liberal Facebook pages. I'm not going to pretend that liberals and progressives cannot be a little cocky and a little full of themselves, a little self-righteous, because they can. And even there are sometimes when I want to slap them, literally, because of just the amount of self-righteousness that pours out of them to the point of almost seeming like they're they're lost in their own goodness. So I'm not going to pretend about that fact, because it is true. Nonetheless, well, I guess I should also say that There are often times when liberals and progressives are trying to have conversations with conservatives, and they're not doing it from a consciously empathetic standpoint with the conservative. They're doing it from the standpoint of, I know I'm right. I have the facts. You do not. You know you're wrong. Accept it and just come on over here. And that's a hard position to argue from, because the person who you are arguing with has always been, most of the time, you know, because you're, most of them are used to being told that they're wrong. There's interesting personality traits of conservatives that I've noticed, and they've gotten kind of tired of it. And so now they don't even hear the word wrong. They just hear the words difference of opinion. But there's still that wall there. And even when the consequences of inaction is dire, most won't surrender to the truth until it is way too late to do anything about it. Way too late. Many Republican farmers in the Midwest, all of this wonderful flooding that has been happening out there, and I don't mean that actually, I mean it's kind of horrific. But the reason why I say wonderful flooding is because it is obviously a pattern traceable to global warming. And to hear many of these states' rights Republicans tell it. It had nothing to do with global warming. It's just something that kind of happened. Which is just scientifically unfeasible. But anyway, the reason why we can't have these conversations is because we're speaking in two very different languages, and there is no such thing as compassionate conservatism, even though George W. Bush tried to push that heavily. The idea that seems to be undergirding most conservatives, corporate conservatives, is because that's basically what they end up being, unfortunately, is this idea that the world is cruel, the world is a jungle, and the strongest one or two survive. And the primary principle that the progressives and liberals seem to be pushing is, we survive if we all come together. And so we're starting off talking two very different languages. The problem with this is, issues that were just a blip on the screen causing some social ripples and turbulence 40 years ago have gone unsolved. And now these issues, which were just causing ripples, are causing social quakes that are ripping apart regions and sometimes even whole states. And yet we cannot have a legitimate, fact-based discussion about these things. I had something happen to me. As you know, I'm very personal on this podcast. I'll tell you the stories of what influences my thinking. I had something happen. A friend of mine, who I've known since I was a child, he's a couple of years older than me, ex-military, grew up in a very Christian home, which was kind of weird because his parents were kind of hippie-ish and used to be major, major partiers and drug users, and then they turned into very vapid conservative Christians. And I'll tell you, and I don't mean any disrespect to any Christians listening, but I can remember their transformation. And I remember their conversion. And I remember saying to somebody another friend of mine when I was old enough to really contemplate this stuff, I said, you know, it's almost like they've been possessed. That's how different they are. And that's how different they look. And I wasn't lying. I am not saying that, you know, if you believe in Christianity, you're possessed or anything like that. But it was how I interpreted it then, because of their change was so dramatic. It was so dramatic. That said, my friend served the country, went into the military, came home. And him and I were talking. He had posted something on Facebook, which questioned why, if he was a Republican, and he is, and he supported Trump, you know, why well, not questioned, but it stated that, you know, people shouldn't believe that he is racist. And without getting too far into it, I gave to him the reason why particularly black people might view him as a racist. He did not want to even hear. He ignored portions of what I wrote, picked and chose what he wanted to respond to, and questioned the history, which would give black people the reasons behind, you know, looking at Republicans as racist. And so I rattled off about four or five of them that were a few decades old. And he dismissed them, mainly because they were a few decades old, and kind of ridiculed the idea still. I returned with more recent evidence suggesting it, not even really dipping into some of the tactics that were used in Georgia to deprive Stacey Abrams of the governorship, not talking about what's going on in Florida and the fact that their governor just implemented a poll tax to ensure that the million people who had just gotten the right to vote, one out of five of them black men, or black people, can't, it's one of the two, one out of five, that means 200,000 of them are going to be black. They didn't even talk about the number of Latinos or what have you, but essentially disenfranchising them all over again. And we know how most of those black folks are going to, you know, vote. They ain't voting for Republicans. I didn't talk about the conservative Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act. I didn't talk about that. And he still ignored it. And he still dismissed it. Instead, constantly referencing his experience. Constantly referencing his importance. And the validity of his words. And the invalidity or the invalidness of mine. And I realized, as we went back over the course of a week, back and forth over the course of a week, as I was showing compassion and I was not attacking him, and at one point I even wrote to him because he kept taking things that I would say, and I think probably most of you have experienced this too. I've experienced this when talking with conservatives, that they take criticisms of the party as personal assaults to their character. And so I actually wrote him an extended message and said, I'm not attacking you, man. This isn't about you. This is about the party that you love. I'm glad you love it, but do me a favor and reform it. He didn't even agree to that, which told me who he really was. But at the end of the conversation, where he decided that he was done, I had asked him a couple of times, but I asked him one last time, and I said, so what are your solutions for fixing this country? Because you obviously have them, let's have them. He has yet to respond to me. I don't believe he will. I think he's probably done with the conversation. But it opened my eyes to a real problem. It opened my eyes to a real problem. And I know I've seen this before. But the solidification of this mindset that is almost trauma-based, that is almost psychically numbed, is massively concerning to me, because this country has massive, massive important decisions to make over the coming couple of, well, the coming decade. And if this is going to be how public discourse is going to shape up, ladies and gentlemen, this country is doomed. And I'll be honest with you, I think places like China, I think they know it. I think, you know, the Chinese are not stupid. They've read history. They see what, they see the trajectory that this country is on, and it isn't good. Now, I'm going to get to a piece that I found, which is why I really did this this episode today. Out of Newsweek, the title of which is called House Republican Mass Shooting Strategy Revealed in Leaked Memo. Blame the Left. Minimize White Supremacy Role. But I want to talk very quickly about this trajectory, because we need to be very conscious of this. We need to be. And as I've constantly said, ladies and gentlemen, this is not something, I know people want to keep acting like it's just, you know, 30 years old, 40 years old. This thing goes back to the 60s. In fact, it probably likely goes back to FDR. Because if you really look at, especially when it comes to the corporatist conservative party, when the Republican Party, after Eisenhower, became the party of Nixon and Goldwater and the Southern Strategy and hardcore corporatist capitalism, if you look at the presidents that were elected, and the outlier, which is the craziest darn thing to think about, the outlier in there, because every other president really went after the quote left. They were just diametrically opposed to the left as it was defined in the 60s. Every single one of them opposed it and went after it and sought to destroy it. The outlier, and maybe history will judge me incorrect on this, is probably Bush 1. Because even though I have to imagine he did some damage, I mean, I barely remember Bush 1's term in office. Reagan was out front about his disdain for the left. Bush, too, was out front about his disdain for the left. Trump is dramatically out front about his disdain for the left. Nixon was out front about his disdain for the left. Ford was out front about his disdain for the left. You seeing a pattern here? The last Republican president that actually governed for the whole country was Eisenhower. Eisenhower. Nixon gave in to pressure because the left was very strong, and I like what Chris Hedges says. He was afraid of mass movements, so he had to give something away to keep leftists pretty calm and pretty happy. But from the end of his election, or excuse me, his presidency, to the beginning of Reagan's, corporatist America, in alignment with the CIA, in alignment with all the other organs that they could get their little grubby hands on, including universities, they went after the left. And they did it gleefully. And it wasn't as if it stopped when Reagan got into office. It intensified. Conservative media spent the 80s, 90s, and 2000s beating up on the left. And corporations spent those same decades buying universities, eliminating leftist professors, eliminating leftist programs in the university. The university has always been conservative. Always. It has to be. It is literally conserving the spirit through academia of the country. So it's always been conservative. It's just you've had more humanities and other artistic things and, you know, softening subjects to keep it from becoming a completely whole tool of capitalism. By the mid-1990s, late 1990s, that was pretty much dead or dying. It is not difficult for a country like China to see what is happening to the United States of America. When you have corporations and you have associations, I'm talking about civic governmental associations here, advocating that businesses and foreign countries buy up municipal assets. By municipal assets, what I mean is those things which you and I utilize, which used to be called public utilities, buy them up, make money off of them, jack up the prices however high they want to until the people start screaming bloody murder and then they have to stop. When you have a society that is promoting this as a saving grace for, quote, budgetary problems that would be solved if corporations paid all of their taxes in their fair share, and I'm not talking about 35%, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about a fair share. If a corporation is making $100 million in a dang quarter, they need to be making on the top end of that, they need to be paying 70%. And they need to be paying it for one simple reason. Those corporations did not make that money. The people in that corporation made that money. I'm trying not to get off on that because that's a very big thing for me. The people in that corporation made that money. They owed the society which those people came from that cut. Nobody's going to be hurt because they don't have an additional, I don't know, the upper level would probably be 50 to 100 million. So from that 50, you're talking about $35 million going into the tax, the tax collector's pocket to pay for things. No one's going to be poor for that. They're still getting their money. When you have a society that looks at something like a corporation, which is a created entity by humans, and that society then begins to treat it like it's a created entity from its or by itself, that it perpetuates itself, that it created itself, and that it needs to be respected like a human being. When you have a society that is delusioned to that level and cannot back up and say, that's ridiculous, we're not doing this, we need to fix our society, we're going to get the money from the corporations, no more loopholes, none of that. It's not difficult for any intelligent historian to see where that society is headed. It is my belief China knows exactly where we're headed. It has done the work. In fact, I don't know how many of you remember this. Some years ago, man, it seems like 12 or 13. I want to say it was before Obama was elected, but it maybe wasn't. The Republican Party, or it wasn't really Republican Party, it was one of its little offshoot PAC organizations or whatever they were called before Citizen United. They created this very, very interesting and disturbing video. It was a commercial. And it involved a Chinese professor talking in front of a Chinese class of students, and the Chinese professor talking in Chinese, it was interpreted, of course, into English, was telling his class the Roman Empire, the United States of America, and I think there was another one. All of them had a major issue. They spent too much money, blah, 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 and then the society crashed. This was purportedly from the future looking back. This actually upset enough people where they actually had to stop running it. It made enough people upset, so they had to stop running it. But that essentially was the Republican Party saying that they already know that the things that they are doing, I mean, honest to God, that video that said that they knew that what they were doing in years to come would be seen as destructive to the United States of America and would be a contributor to the downfall of the United States of America. Now, some of you may find that hard to believe. Wait a minute. They were making a statement about the Democrats and spending too much. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a flipped dynamic. It's a flipped dynamic. The Republicans were making the case that there needed to be a decrease in spending. At the same time, they were making the case that there needed to be tax cuts for the wealthy. It's a flipped logic. So we're spending too much, but we still need to cut taxes for the wealthy. They know that what they are doing is harming the social body of the United States of America, and they don't care. And I want to be very clear about this, because some of them do care. But they care to serve the wealthy better. They care to serve the wealthy more. And because a lot of those who are voting for them believe that they are voting for the same, quote, Republican principles that led to the United States becoming its own independent nation, principles which most of them really don't have a clue about because they want to reform those principles. But because they don't want to even consider that those principles need to be reformed, but they still believe that they're holding on to the principles of the Founding Fathers, they don't see it. They don't want to see it. The problem is those who want to spend money, not those who want to keep giving it to the wealthy. I will never, ever forget in my life, I think it was 2002, early 2002 at that, Bush was riding a wave of popularity, and he was in a meeting with James Baker? Oh, I don't want to get the name wrong, but with a very well-respected Republican, old-school Republican economist. And they were having a discussion about what to do with the economy. The economy was in a recession, as it often is. And Cheney had said, well, cut taxes to the wealthy. It'll help. It'll stimulate the economy. And this man, this very respected conservative Republican economist, recounted the story of what happened. George W. Bush looked at Cheney and said, but wait a minute, didn't we just give money to the wealthy? Maybe we should start giving some to the American people. And before anyone else could chime in, Mr. Cheney said, Mr. President, stick to, you know, the script or whatever. Stick to the whatever. And pretty much that was his argument for continuously cutting taxes for the wealthy. Just stick to it. No matter if it works or not, stick to it. That ultimately led to this very well-respected Republican conservative economist leaving the administration. The vice president didn't even want to hear logical economic science that said, look, if you do it this way, it helps. If you do it that way, it doesn't. And this is where we're at right now. People don't want to hear the logical economic science. They don't want to hear the logical environmental science, anything else. This is dangerous, ladies and gentlemen. I'm back to that again. Yes, it's dangerous. It is very dangerous. And it's going to continue to be, it's going to actually continue to be dangerous. We need to, we have to work to convert the pessimism, the hostility, we have to work to convert all of that into trust. And I'm going to tell you, you know, before I dive into this article, I have seen it. I have seen what conservative media does to a small town. Especially as that small town is economically dying. I come from a pretty small town. I'd have to look to see what the population is, but I'm confident it's under 10,000. It would surprise me if it's over. It would surprise me if it's actually 10,000. In fact, I think it's about half that. Anyway. Over the past 12 years, I'll just say over the past 20 years, really. That community which I grew up in, graduated from school from, they have experienced a slow economic death. When I graduated from school, there were three or four major manufacturers in the community which provided a number of the jobs in the boom, really. I mean, I can remember, you know, how busy summers became. I also remember, and it's kind of weird to think about this, how bright winters were, because a lot of the work was seasonal. And so when I was a child, before New York State amended its unemployment laws, which the amendment is just darn right stupid when you don't have a economy that's booming. Before they amended their laws, you could, as long as you had a date to return to work, you could collect unemployment throughout the winter months, or however long you were laid off, and you didn't have to look for another job. Well, because the policies which have been enacted for the last 30 years have decimated the economic base of the country, places like New York passed laws that said, nope, even if you have a return date, or roughly a return date, they would even let you, as long as you knew that you had a job in the spring, they didn't even really need the return date. But because of the damage that their policies have done, they now say you have to be looking no matter what. And it's even gotten to the point where now it's, if you don't take a job, like before they would say, it has to pay similarly to what you'd be leaving behind. But now it's, if you don't take the job, we don't have to give you unemployment. I mean, it's, I remember the brightness of the town when you had all these parents who were laid off from work. They were still making decent amounts of money from the unemployment. And they were able to go and do things with their kids and, you know, keep their families well fed, and things were good. But as times grew harder, people began to, and I noticed this probably around 2001, they became very stuck on conservatism. And it took me far too long to understand why this was. I mean that. I didn't like figure it out until 2017 that a lot of them just wanted things to be, I mean, I knew it, I think, that a lot of them just wanted things to be how it was, and that's why they wanted conservatism, but they just didn't understand the philosophy so much that the corporations were pushing. Anyway, I saw it, though, and I remember getting into conversations and arguments with people about this conservative idea. And that, after a while, I realized there was no arguing with it. And people would literally get angry at me when I brought them facts. And that's when I started realizing I'm dealing, and actually, it was hit home by Chris Hedges. I started realizing that I was dealing with people who were psychically numbing themselves. Because at the same time as this conservatism was rising, I did notice there was a lot more drug use. I mean, there had always been drug use in the community, but drinking, smoking marijuana, doing other hard drugs, that was all on the increase. It was all on the increase. And people clung to the conservatism. They did. I know you're not supposed to say they don't cling to it, they believe in it. No, they clung to it. You cling to something that's use isn't beneficial when you consider the evidence against its use. That's clinging. That's clinging. Just like a lot of progressives cling to progressivism, which isn't well-defined, instead of just saying, you know something, we're going to need to really evolve this system, we now have to choose socialism or something else. Because they believe that through this mechanism, things will restore themselves the way that they were. Ain't gonna happen. But I'm glad they're playing at home. I'm glad they're playing at home. But it's not going to happen. And when I stress that with these individuals who are attached to conservatism, most of them would say, well, how do you know? They would get angry. How do you know? I mean, who are you to say this? I said, you're right, I'm nobody. I'm just looking at the trajectory. I'm looking at the events. I'm looking at the fact that we have done some of this before in the history of this country, and it took us a hell of a lot of change to stop it from happening. We don't even have on our radar the ideas that were presented in the early 1900s to stop capitalism from doing what it's doing now, which is becoming very, very metastasized. To the point of threatening the environment, threatening communities, societies, families, basically threatening the world. We don't even have the righteous mind to call capitalism out for what it's doing. That's how I know. That's how I know. That didn't really sit well with them either. So, like I said, it's dangerous. To the main reason why I'm doing this individual episode, this wonderful article, which I referenced much, much earlier, not 43, almost 44 minutes in, I'm going to start tackling this because it is very, 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 very vital that we talk about this. The title of this, again, is Strategy Revealed in Leaked Memo. Oh, I'm sorry. It's from Newsweek, published on the 16th of August, 2019. The title is House Republican Mass Shooting Strategy Revealed in Leaked Memo. Blame the Left, Minimize White Supremacy Role. This is by Matt Keeley. Fun fact, I actually went to school with a Keeley. Now, I want to read some of this. I'm not sure if I'm going to read it all, but I do want to read some of it because I think you'll find it as intriguing as I find it. A recently leaked memo from House Republicans shows that the GOP is urging its politicians to blame recent mass shootings on the left while downplaying the role of white supremacy. According to the Tampa Bay Times, who obtained the memo, the document offers talking points in response to common questions Republican representatives may face after the recent mass shootings. The paper describes most of the offered responses as, quote, boilerplate Republican arguments against tougher gun restrictions, unquote. However, the Times spotlights the answer. The memo suggests, in response to the question, do you believe white nationalism is driving more mass shootings recently? The answer, quote, white nationalism and racism are pure evil and cannot be tolerated in any form, unquote, the document says. Quote, we also can't excuse violence from the left, such as the El Paso shooter, the recent Colorado shooters, the congressional baseball shooter, Congresswoman Giffords shooter, and Antifa, unquote. Now, let me reread that, because that's actually very important, but as I was reading it, I'm thinking back, trying to, you know, place all of these things. The document says, quote, we also can't excuse violence from the left, such as the El Paso shooter, the recent Colorado shooters. I don't believe the El Paso shooter was a leftist. He literally wrote a manifesto which used language taken directly from Trump. Anyway, the congressional baseball shooter, which I think was in 2010, Congresswoman Giffords shooter, 2011, I think, and Antifa, which is laughable. I don't believe Antifa's done any mass shootings. Continuing, the El Paso shooter identified as Patrick Crucius, which I forgot that his last name was Crucius, but wow, that's kind of intriguing. Identified as Patrick Crucius, and the reason why it's intriguing, kind of as a side note, ladies and gentlemen, I am just fascinated with this Roman Republic podcast right now, and Crucius just sounds like a Roman name. Anyway, the El Paso shooter, identified as Patrick Crucius, killed 22 people at a Walmart. In statements to police, Crucius said he was targeting Mexicans. A manifesto linked with Crucius, posted to 8chan, ranted against the Hispanic invasion of Texans and argued for the murder of Latinx immigrants. Rep. Gus Belarenkas of Palm Harbor, Florida, included these points in a newsletter this week. Summer Robertson, a spokeswoman for the representative, told the Times, the points were provided by the House Republican Conference, which is behind the party's messaging strategy. Quote, we have sadly seen violence from ideological extremes on both sides, and that is completely unacceptable and must be condemned, Robertson told the paper. Congressman Belarenkas has always been clear that he denounces bigotry and hate speech, regardless of its source, including from white nationalists, unquote. Robinson said the reference to El Paso was a mistake. No, that is not a mistake. That is a huge revision. Again, Robinson said the reference to El Paso was a mistake in that Belarenkas meant to refer to Dayton, okay, I could see that, Ohio shooting, which happened hours after the incident in El Paso. Connor Betts, the alleged shooter, was reported to have protested at a KKK rally and is described as a democratic socialist. Betts was reportedly obsessed with death and violence, however, and made a kill list of women he wanted to murder. Okay, first and foremost, he may have protested at a Ku Klux Klan rally, but to say that the kid was a democratic socialist when he went to an area which was known to kind of be frequented by people who might not look like him, and shot a whole bunch of them, that doesn't sound very democratic socially to me. Anyway, continuing. Though the shooter at the 2017 congressional baseball game was identified as a left-wing activist targeting Republicans, oh my God, was that really in 2017? Wait a minute, there was another one that occurred before that. And yeah, I think that one was a left winger too. Wow, was that really? Oh, okay. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. I guess that was 2017. My God, it seems like it was way before that. But I guess not. Though the shooter at the 2017 congressional baseball game was identified as a left-wing activist targeting Republicans, the other shootings named in the GOP memo have a more ambiguous connection to the left. Rep. Gifford is a Democrat, and the shooter in that instance was determined to be paranoid about government in general. His politics were mixed between right and left and not believed to be a factor. According to an investigation by law enforcement, the Colorado incident this May is also believed to not have been motivated by politics. Conservative commentators have downplayed the connection between recent shootings and white supremacy. Now, here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen, because this is actually the point that I wanted to get to in this article, but I did want to give you the rest of it. Conservative commentators have downplayed the connection between recent shootings and white supremacy. Why would they do that? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to admit. Okay? Woven into corporate conservatism, because that's what this conservatism is. We need to start calling it out for what it is. This corporate conservatism, woven into it is racism. Woven into it is white supremacy. Woven into it is a history of bigotry. And I want to be very, very clear about this, ladies and gentlemen, because I'm tired of seeing the issue of white supremacy only come up when it is beneficial to some narrative which excludes the actual content. in context of why white supremacy was created. See, it doesn't surprise me. It, honest to God, does not surprise me that corporate conservatism has white supremacy woven into it. Why not? Because capitalism, its earliest manifestations as imperialism was getting underway, which was, if we want to be somewhat accurate, I guess, outside of the feudalist system in Europe, imperialism was what started the trek onwards to modern-day capitalism. Within that, and not from every, you know, every person that was in, engaged in imperialism didn't actually have this as a social philosophy, but within the development, alongside the development of capitalism, was this notion of race hierarchy and white European supremacy. So when you have a philosophy, and we call it an ideology, but a philosophy, like corporate conservatism, you will, which by the way, it draws its inspiration, conservative mind, ladies and gentlemen, from the supposed earliest workers and writers and philosophers of this republic, all of which, almost to a T, not only believed in white supremacy and the inherent inferiority of non-white people, but most of them had slaves and believed that was the proper place for black people. In other words, corporate conservatism has woven within it white nationalism and white supremacy because capitalism within it has woven into it white nationalism and white supremacy. This is the real reason. This is the real reason, ladies and gentlemen, why they're so fearful of getting rid of capitalism. Socialist concepts have been around this planet for eons. You could find socialist concepts in Africa. You could find it in Asia. You could find it in North and South America. You could find it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You could find it in Australia. You could even find some of them in Europe before the Catholic Church and the monarchs got done with those people. In other words, racism didn't exist. Without racism, and this is what is barely ever said, this is never actually said, because people don't know what racism is. But if you research racism, you'll find out something very interesting. For every race, there are sub-races. There are subcategories. I'm not talking about the garbage they have on the census. That's nonsense. No, you go back to the 1800s, the early 1900s, when they were solidifying this philosophy. And what you find is within the race, they have a hierarchy. They have a hierarchy which puts the lightest white person, considered a WASP, at the top, and the darkest black person at the bottom. That's the racial hierarchy. But, within those races themselves, there are also classes. Conservatism, when it's drawn from this capitalist corporatism, or this corporatist capitalism, I mean, it's the same. People keep trying to act as if you can save capitalism by making everything cooperatives, and, you know, you can amend corporations and thus amend capital. It's never going to happen. Because capitalism's survival means racism survival. The minute you get rid of racism, and this is why the body, the social body politic of Europe right now, and now I'm talking about in the United States, pan-European as it is expressed in the United States, why it is convulsing. What do I mean by convulsing? Why is it that in order to talk about white supremacy, you have to talk about brown skin, light brown skin, Latinos. That's the only time when I hear no disagreement about what is white supremacy and what is racism. There was a man who was just recently killed. I think he was in Salem, Massachusetts, but don't quote me on that. He had stood up for a bartender. This white man was harassing her. And he left the bar. And he was shot by that white man who he had defended the bartender against, died. They said, the police officer said, they didn't have any proof yet to say that it was racially motivated. When we want to talk about racism, we can talk about brown people. We want to talk about white supremacy, let's talk about brown people. Once when we move to black, whoa. We need some amazing evidence. You get rid of white supremacy as a notion. You get rid of racism as both a notion and an institution. Capitalism is done. That is exactly why corporate conservatives downplay. They say we need to downplay the connection of white supremacy to these mass shootings because they know corporatism requires racism. What is a corporation? Ladies and gentlemen, you live in them. Oh, you didn't know? Most of your towns say incorporated in da 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 da. Your town is a corporation. That is why it has bonds. This whole country was developed as a corporation. And part of that corporate structure is racism. Just like any big corporation has a culture and a philosophy underpinning it. I was going to say a philosophical underpinning, but, you know, either one of them works. Racism is one of the core components of this corporation, this United Corporation. I don't know, what do we want to call it? The United Corporate States. UCS. Racism is one of the founding pillars. In fact, I'd probably even argue that, forget about one of the founding pillars, it's one of the key components of making the stone and marble and what have you for the pillars, which is why they're so afraid to take it out. There's a bit more. I'm probably not going to read the rest, but I do think, because they mention everyone's favorite man, Tucker Carlson. Oh, that actually is it. I thought there was a bit more to this. But I think because they mention everyone's favorite man, Tucker Carlson, I will finish reading this bit. Conservative commentators have downplayed the connection between recent shootings and white supremacy. Fox News host Tucker Carlson was placed on leave after calling white supremacists or white supremacy's hoax. Which, that's not actually what he called it, but whatever. Trump official Kellyanne Conway defended Carlson, saying that white supremacy received outsized coverage. I believe that would be called oversized coverage. Remember how I was saying that any country could see the trajectory that the United States is on? When you have a government official making statements such as outsized instead of oversized, any country can see where your country's headed. There's also something else that's going on, and I give Brad Friedman great credit for this, because I've already talked about this. I've been about this for a long time. The thing that I love about people like Brad Friedman is they give me the information on it. There is a ripping apart of the government going on, and most of us don't even realize it. And this is something that we need to be very focused on, because what they're essentially doing is they're tearing your apart. They're tearing your government, the structures of this society, which is built to maintain social stability. They are tearing them apart because they want corporations to be able to either use those resources, those financial resources, for themselves, or they want corporations to come in and do the job and charge you as a taxpayer way more money than they should. Now, I just wanted to mention that because Brad Friedman covered this story about a obscure but important, when you look at it from a farmer's standpoint, bureau, which was being downsized dramatically and moved. Hundreds of employees, government employees, were leaving the department due to this downsizing and this moving. It is vitally important to farmers that this department keep going. The majority of the people that this is going, well, not the majority, but the people that are going to feel this are those same people who are in the Midwest and those diehard red states who don't realize that Trump just cut their throats because he is taking away a department which helped them plan crops and where to plant them at, how they're doing, all kinds of stuff that they probably took for granted. Gone. The Republicans will likely blame Democrats for it. And they'll probably believe them. All right, so this one went really, really long. And I was actually going to keep going, but, you know, this one went well over an hour. So I'm just going to call it right now. Questions, comments, concerns, leave them with me. I look forward to hearing from you guys. Try to be compassionate to those who do not believe the same things you do. When you know that you've seen it, I believe we can win people over. It's going to take some time, but we can do it. This is your brother, Vahmi Adis. I'll see ya. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the